Welcome to the System Speak podcast, a podcast about dissociative identity disorder. If you are new to the podcast, we recommend starting at the beginning episodes and listen in order to hear our story and what we have learned through this endeavor. Current episodes may be more applicable to longtime listeners and are likely to contain more advanced topics, emotional or other triggering content, and/or reference earlier episodes that provide more context to what we are currently learning and experiencing. As always, please care for yourself during and after listening to the podcast. Thank you.
We took a little break because that was intense.
We took a bio break.
A bio break. Gamers. Okay, so we are still talking about the presentation by Ana Gomez. Mm-hmm. The next section was talking about anxious attachment, which she says the strategy is approach.
Yeah.
So do you have anything before I read the first thing?
No.
She said it is a response to unpredictable, undependable, and intrusive care that prevents and hinders differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
It develops clinginess and over-focus on the caregiver. I would phrase that as hypervigilance for fawning.
Yeah.
Like, how do I feed the tiger so that I don't get eaten? How do I be good at being good? Mm-hmm. How do I read the room, read the people, and be able to predict what they are feeling, what they are needing, how I can get it right?
Right. Well, and she talked about that this attachment, like, this response is, so they're in a high constant state of activation and they're always working to get the caregiver to stay and looking for moments when their caregiver is available for connection because it's so unpredictable. So they have to be constantly ready, like you said, hyper vigilant to watch for those moments when they can get the connection, when they can get it.
When these people come to my office, they think they are coming for anxiety. I see that it's actually hypervigilance, mm-hmm. not anxiety. And then we have to work together to figure out what are we being hypervigilant about. Which is interesting because sometimes it can look like flight as well. People who are really good at flight. But it doesn't show up as much as that. That shows up more, I think, with avoidance. It can look like flight. But this, there's a hypervigilance that instead of flighting from the danger, they're flighting toward the danger. Why are you trying so hard to hold on to what is not good for you? That is what is hurting you. And you are squeezing on as hard as you can. Well, oh, I'm sorry. You know,
I mean, I can tell you why.
Tell me.
Because there's nothing else.
Oh.
So it's either hold on tight to that and hope they don't get tired of you, or just be left alone in the Sahara for the tigers to find.
What a double bind is that?
Yeah.
So double binds in avoidance strategy and
anxious.
Approach strategy.
Yeah.
We can't win either way.
No.
Oh, that's why it's not healthy.
Right. These are not the secure attachment strategies. You don't need a strategy when it's healthy and secure.
Oh, snap. I feel like you just said something really important.
Well, you don't need a strategy because you're just getting your needs met and you get to just be yourself. And you have someone responding to you instead of you having to respond to them.
Oh.
Sorry.
question,
mm-hmm.
you can pass. Is that why it's hard for you when we care for you? Because it's not just that you're not supposed to take up space or not be seen, but because your survival depends on doing the caring.
Yeah.
So if I'm caring for you, then your survival is at risk.
Yeah. And I can't get used to it because it will not stay. So it's dangerous to want it because it's going to go away. Does that make sense? So that's where it's so confusing, because so much of how I show up in relationships is the anxious, but also very much avoidant of my own needs. Which, so that's a piece that I wrote down, and it says, these adults are constant caretakers with the complete dissociation from self. So maybe I'm only anxious, and my avoidance is internal, because of its sacrificing for the external.
Wow.
That's pleasant.
That's a lot, love.
Yeah. Should we finish reading this slide?
Well, I'm thinking, mm-hmm. and again, we keep consenting as we go, and we can also change our minds later. But I'm just applying this to us. It's interesting that we keep reenacting it. You don't want care to be taken away, so you keep leaving me. I mean, literally, because you have a house. We don't live together. That's the yeah. public part. I can yeah. say that people don't know, because Nanya, like, we do not live together.
Right.
And also, I am avoidant. No, I don't even want to say it like that anymore. I want to say I use avoidance as a strategy by just being okay with it.
How about this? You were taught avoidance as a strategy.
And now reenact it by being okay with being left.
It's so gross.
Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Without it being in any way accusatory or, yeah. oh, we should change this or fix this. Like, just
yeah.
clear seeing.
Yeah.
Only pieces clear on the, seeing.
Pieces of the puzzle on the board. Yeah.
It makes me want to vomit on the board.
Well, that would take care of all those pieces.
Let's use those baby wipes and just dump that right into the trash.
Right. One thing she talked about was that the actual thing that you need, that these children need, is the thing that they will push away and reject. So, like, I need care and attention. And so I actively push it away. And, like, I have a visceral response to care.
Yes.
Hence the carebusters.
Carebusters. Which I experience as getting it wrong in a need to be punished by Dante kind of way.
Yeah.
I don't mean that's your fault. I mean, again, how
mm-hmm.
it intersects together or plays, like, how trauma happens and interacts, or I don't know the right words in English, what I'm trying yeah. to say.
Well, it's like we were the perfect
storm.
Oh no
our poor therapist.
Yeah, but we're doing the work and looking at the pieces.
So, okay, legit question, maybe a little bit of panic. What is the difference between the perfect storm in a trauma bonding way and the perfect storm for opportunity to grow kind of way? The staying.
The staying and the conversations, the hard conversations about it. If we were just avoiding looking at it and continuing to fawn and utilize our trauma response strategies, we would have the longest, most codependent relationship ever, right?
I do not want that.
No.
And do not need that again.
Right. But I think why it's different is that we are actually bringing our pieces to the table, looking at the puzzle together, seeing how, wow, this is really could be nasty if we let it be. So how are we going to not let it be? And then we're really being brave and trying new things, like letting you celebrate me for my birthday and like take care of me and
happy birthday, love.
Yeah. So we're doing the things.
And I think a really important piece of that is sharing presence, looking at the table with all the pieces, but you have to do your own puzzle and I have to do my own puzzle.
Yeah.
We can be there together in it, but it is a puzzle with a picture of a fireball on it.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those like world's most difficult puzzles where you can't ever figure out if the piece fits or not.
But our therapists are like the picture on the box, reflecting back to us accurately, not doing it for us, because it's our puzzle, but reflecting back accurately so that we can see the puzzle pieces clearly.
It is brutal and incredibly rude.
So rude. Oh my goodness. Okay, so that kind of leads to the next thing in what it looks like when it's not healthy, mm-hmm. is the next thing for approach strategy for anxious attachment is sacrificing exploration in the service of connection. What does that mean?
Well, having lived my life that way, I can explain. It is highly risk averse. I was literally the child who would tell other children, like I had a friend that had a trampoline and they would love to jump on it, and I would be the one on the ground saying, be careful, don't get hurt, you're gonna get hurt. Like I couldn't even play with the kids because I was so scared of something bad happening. And so I am extremely risk averse. Everything looks dangerous.
What a scary place when you're so alone, especially.
Yeah. And responsible to keep everyone around you safe.
We must be exhausting for you in the context of so many changes. Not even maliciously, but oh, we live here now. Oh, kids live here too. Oh, some kids have left. Oh, some kids are back. Oh, this is happening. Oh, we have a new house now. Oh, and this. Like I'm on a trampoline constantly.
A little bit.
I'm so sorry, love.
It's okay. It's really good practice for me to learn what is actually dangerous and what is actually safe enough.
Like seeing clearly again.
Yeah.
Oh, like in the book, like we need accurate information.
Yeah. Yeah. So for kiddos that have to use the approach strategy, they learn that they can't go out and explore the world. It's not safe to do that. Everything feels safe. They have to, or unsafe. They give up all of that exploration to stay at home base because they have to be available when their caregiver is available. Does that make sense?
So it's actually a big deal that you even talk to me at all.
Kind of.
Wow.
No.
Oh, it is. Like, I feel like we need to honor that piece. Mm. Oh, wait, that's doing the thing, is it? I'm celebrating you and giving you space. I'm sorry, we can run that back a little bit.
It's okay.
Okay, moving on. Let me rescue you from your fireball. No, okay, I'm not going to rescue you from your fireball.
Yeah.
It is a big deal, and I just want to honor and hold space. I'm sorry it's uncomfortable for you, but I'm not going to not do it.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Of it's a big deal that you've added me to your life at all.
Yeah.
When it feels so scary to explore the world.
Yeah. And to have needs or a self.
So can I just thank you without too much tending? Just thank you for having the courage and tenacity to love me.
Yes. And it is always my pleasure to get to love you. Even when it's scary. Not because it's bad or dangerous, but because I think everything is dangerous.
Okay.
We're not even done with the slide yet.
I will let us move forward. Thank you for taking up a tiny space for a moment.
You are welcome.
I love you in my world. Mm. I love life with you. I love the way my body feels in your presence. I don't mean like that. That head nod.
Yeah, you do.
I mean the settled, regulating presence that we share together.
Yeah.
Is meaningful and powerful to me. Without the masking of needing to hide gayness or try to be straightness or try to be anything. Like when I am with you, the masks come down. Mm-hmm. And that is not just a comfort to me, it is a relief to me. I can just be myself and you are still here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. The next one, is this talking about fawning or something else? It says, works hard to maintain connection, meeting the needs of the parent. So not meeting our own needs. Right. If I can work harder, I could do better.
If I could do it better. Yeah. It is fawning. It's like, I'm going to keep meeting your needs better and better to try to get more and more connection from you.
So anytime we are fawning, it is an indicator that at least in that moment we are using an approach strategy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which means it's also an indicator that we are experiencing unmet needs.
Right, and maybe even unmet needs that, or need meeting that is unpredictable or undependable or intrusive.
Well, how does that feel?
Gross.
I am not excited about it myself.
No, me neither. But I'm less excited about the next piece. So I don't know what's better, to stay with this grossness or go to the next even grosser.
I think, here's what I will say about this one. I think where I've experienced this recently, meaning like as an adult rather than a child, because that's easier to talk about, is actually with Nathan. And I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but he has been good and kind and safe in lots of ways. And also, I can't undo being gay, right? Like, I need to still keep telling myself that out loud. And also, a lot of struggles with depression and medical trauma of his own, that without any malicious intent, like not making him the bad guy, but without any malicious intent, made it really hard to know when he was functioning or not, or could co-parent or not. And I don't mean this in a shaming way. It is what he has talked about it on the podcast with me. It's public. But I think it's part of what made that codependent sometimes, because I had to take really good care of him so that he could participate in parenting for me. And it was all out of balance and healthy.
Yeah.
All out of balance and unhealthy. Even without anyone trying to hurt anyone. So just again for context, so sometimes those patterns playing out without it being malicious intent. This is not about making other people the bad guys. This is about honoring our own experiences and seeing clearly what is happening so that we can tend to it. And in this example, Nathan and I did, like with the codependent no more episodes and the real life with those episodes, right? So I think that's really all I can add safely with this piece right now.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one that you're so excited about says they are high reactors. After so many failed attempts, anger comes, and with it, shame.
Yeah. So she was saying that these children look really independent. No. Really good at caring for the people around them. But when that fails, when they don't get the connection over and over and over and over, eventually they, like, have meltdowns. That are like big and ugly anger, and then like intense shame afterwards. So, there's that.
Okay, the protector episode that you and listeners have not got to hear yet, from when I talked to Rick Hoffler again. He's been on the podcast before talking about shame, because it's kind of his specialty, not shaming people, helping people with shame.
Yeah.
Just to be clear. One of the things he talked about in the context of conversations about protectors and anger, I brought this up with him because when I talked to him for the podcast last year, it was right in the middle of the online drama. And I was like, I don't understand what this, like, what is the difference between anger and like vitriol? Or what is the difference between advocacy and fight response? And how do you know? And remember, I had Laura Brown on to talk about feminist rage.
Yes.
And she's like, no, that's not a thing.
Uh-huh.
Don't blame that on the feminists.
Right.
And which I appreciated, because I was really struggling to identify with it. But Rick Hoffler pointed out that shame, that anger, is actually a defense to protect us from shame.
Yuck.
So we have protectors and angry parts that try to externalize what we don't want to feel internally.
And in this, what we're feeling internally is shame from repeated abandonment and rejection of unreliable caregivers. So we get really angry to prevent feeling the shame that we're not good enough.
Do you want to stop there?
Nope.
Or take it one step further?
Give me more. Give me more.
Oh my goodness. So in that conversation with Rick,
mm-hmm.
he said the reason that we get angry to protect ourselves from the shame of not feeling good enough is because unconsciously we're aware that it's our caregivers who are already not good enough, meaning their care is not good enough. And if we also feel not good enough, then we are accidentally identifying with our perpetrator.
Oh, well, okay. Can you say that one again?
And so the anger and the shame help us dissociate, because that's what we're actually afraid of. We don't actually feel like we're not good enough. We're actually afraid of not being good enough in the way our caregivers are not good enough. That's what we're dissociating from. So we focus on how not good enough we feel to avoid our own fear of seeing how not good enough our caregivers are. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
May I have some more, please? Sir. Can I have some more?
Please. Ugh, that's brutal. So, like, even, because one of the next ones is the sense of worthlessness and defectiveness. And so even that, even this sense of worthlessness that is at the core of someone's being, not mine, that they carry around their whole life is sacrificing to prevent harm to their caretaker. So, like, I'm going to carry around this cloak of worthlessness to prevent my caregiver from being seen in my eyes as not good enough.
Right. That was an appropriate use of the F-bomb.
Wow.
So the last one about pleasing and sacrificing the self in the service of acceptance, which is fawning, is that if you can be good enough to be accepted by them, then it means also you can make them good enough to be accepted by you, which is why it's fawning is codependency.
Yeah. So this is one of the pieces where she mentioned, like, being addicted to caretaking and acceptance of others, acceptance by others, which felt like, you would say, it stepped all over my toes.
It's the only way you can co-regulate.
Yeah.
Because your caregiver is not co-regulating for you. You co-regulate them so that then they are regulated enough that you can regulate.
Yeah.
Which is really abusive, actually.
Yeah. And then you get addicted to that because it works, that regulating you. And so that's how you learn to regulate throughout your whole life. I mean, other people might do that. What were you gonna say?
Well, I was just thinking relational application, but I didn't know if that was plenty already. You asked for more.
I did. Let's have it.
So what happens relationally for us is that when you are doing that for me, that is when I know you are actually distressed. But you don't want tending to your distress. So you're actually doing to me what you don't want me to do to you. Mm. And because of my kind of trauma, which is not your fault, but involved a lot of specific grooming, when you do that, it actually feels dangerous to me rather than reassuring.
Gross.
Right?
Those are some terrible pieces.
Could I quote your therapist in this moment?
Sure.
this is a lovely opportunity for growth.
A great one. Gross.
So when you are feeling good and safe and social, when you're in your frontal cortex, or when we're tending to your shirts that you allegedly may or may not have at any given moment, depending on if you have misplaced your DID.
If I've done laundry or not.
I love that. It's out for the laundry. When you are in a good place, when we are connected, and even when you're struggling, and you do things for me that are kind or generous or thoughtful or part of an expression of a loving relationship, I love and receive those things, and also do not need those things to love you because I already love you. But if I don't receive those things, then it feels dangerous to you because you are good at fawning, and that is what has meant safety. So if fawning doesn't work, it feels dangerous to you. So my questions in the past about is this real or is this not real were not just like offensive of like, I'm here, I've done all these things, how do you not know this is real? But felt to your brain and to other shirts that life-threatening, we're in danger here because our fawning is not working. That too far?
No, it's wonderful. That's why these things are so hard. Like it would be easy to just take not lots of notes and stay cognitive in these trainings, but actually looking at it pragmatically and feeling it, it is like the most intensive therapy ever.
I love you.
I love you.
You don't have to say it. I'm just reminding you.
It wasn't a hesitation to say, it was a hesitation to not say, even when I'm a fawner.
Well done, love. Well done. Mm-hmm. It's hard sometimes to call out something like that on for both of us, for you to call it out on me or me to call you out on it, because when we fail fawning, we stop using that strategy.
Do you know what she said? She was talking about the avoidance piece, but when you take away a child's defense, all they have left is collapse. And that's what it feels like, even though I know, like, adult brain, adult resources, we have lots of other options. But experientially, it feels like when fawning doesn't work, it is just the end of the road. Like, lay down and let the vultures show up, because that's all there is left.
Yeah. And because we have child states involved, or littles, or younger parts of ourselves, when we say, when something specific gets called out for fawning, this happens with both of us, so me too, just so that we're clear, I am also in the hot seat. Because that fawning strategy did not work, we stop doing that thing. But sometimes that thing, whatever it is actually good and appreciated. It's the fawning that's unhealthy. So then sometimes we fawn about fawning because we don't want the thing to stop or go away altogether. But if I say, oh, that's fawning, like, is this a moment where, I don't mean don't ever do the thing. I mean, do you feel safe enough right now to do the thing? But what we hear and receive is, the thing didn't work, don't do that thing anymore.
Right.
Because then we're fawning about fawning.
We're fawning about unfawning.
Oh!
Well, and here's where it gets so tricksy. Is like I was saying earlier, I can't always tell. When you say, are you feeling safe enough? I literally don't know. Like, when I check inside, there's crickets, nothing. I get no messages. So I just assume that means I'm okay, but I don't actually know because it hasn't fully turned on yet. So then it feels like I can't unfawn.
Which is when I'm like, I don't know that you can actually consent.
Right. But then how, so we just wait for like years for it to turn back on? Like, that's where I get stuck of like, I want to give accurate feedback. I just am not getting anything. So how long do I wait to hear?
I think that's okay to say, because that is the feedback. I think waiting is okay. That's, I don't know. I don't want to, it's partly your fireball for therapy, right? And so we can leave it. And also, I think from the outside, that kind of waiting is different from the kind of waiting you experience as a child that was delay in care, which to your brain feels dangerous. So I'm curious if it also feels dangerous to wait.
Well, when we look back at these anxious approach strategies, right? When it's an unpredictable caregiver, waiting, sometimes it means your window's closed. So if you wait, you won't have the chance again. For me, so like waiting to actually hear what I need means I will miss the chance and I won't get any connection. And connection on your terms is better than no connection at all. Does that make sense?
I already love you. And I am already here. And I am okay because of waiting. So you know I'm telling the truth.
No, I don't actually.
Just being here.
I don't actually know that you're telling the truth. Because you're avoiding. You don't need anything.
Right, which is why I'm fine with waiting.
No, that's not true.
Because I need nothing. See, this is how it happens, right? This is why we have therapists.
Oh, thank God.
So we can continue therapy.
Yeah.
But good for us for seeing the pieces, even if we don't know how they fit together yet, even if we're waiting to see. We're looking. Mm-hmm. That's what matters. Mm-hmm. We're listening. That's what matters. So maybe we can't yet know all the things. I think, honestly, I don't want to get into the politics of this right now, but honestly, it's one of the reasons I cannot identify as plural. I don't have access to any of this stuff that they're able to do. Some people who have practiced it so intentionally, it makes sense that they're better at it. So I don't mean to compare my system and their system. I don't mean I'm bad. I don't mean they're bad. I mean, because I cannot do it, I do not identify with the experience of being open about it because it's easy and a way of life. It is not my way of life.
Right.
So I don't mean they're wrong. I just mean I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where that shows up for me. So I am in part rescuing for your fireball, but only because it's public. We can continue this in therapy. We will continue it in therapy. But I think it's amazing that we can see the pieces clearly from this intense session we had this morning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To keep things exciting, when you have a little bit of avoidance strategy and a little bit of approach strategy, the attachment you get is disorganized. What did she say about this? I will let you read it.
Well, the disorganized attachment is known as the disorganized strategy or dissociation. And what she says about it is that there's this push and pull. So there's two systems simultaneously activated, the attach system and the defense system.
Wait, what does that mean?
It is the, I need to attach to you because I'm a mammal and mammals attach for safety.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah.
Let's go.
At the same time as our lizard brain telling us, whoa, there's danger over there, get away. Right? So.
That's what they're talking about when they say the gas and the brakes?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that has confused me for a long time in the world of metaphors.
That is what's happening. Our mammal brain is in the gas thing. Go towards this person. That's how we survive, is we attach. And this is who's available to attach to. And our lizard brain is saying, gas or brake pedal. That is dangerous over there. Don't go over there. So like at the same time, our need to attach is activated and our need to defend ourselves is activated. So we get approach and avoid together.
Well, can I call myself out on something?
Yeah.
Relationally with us?
Sure.
You know what this tells me? Like, not consciously trying to harm you, but thinking about the things we've learned and been through together over the last year, me wanting to be with you would be approach. So that's putting the gas on of like, oh, I'm going to move 1,000 miles and here I am. Mm-hmm. Also me with avoidance, putting the brakes on of, oh my goodness, I can see it so clearly for a split second. I'm scared it's going to slip away. Putting the brakes on with avoidance, meaning because attachment is a threatening and I do feel good and settled with you and that scares me, then when you have attachment crises of yours and I avoid rescuing you from that, which in some ways is healthy, and also not intentionally, but oh my goodness, I see it so clearly, put the brakes on it by, if I just let you be in the crisis about it, then I am able to avoid the risk of attachment, and we'll just see if that proves me right or proves me wrong. That then is the abandonment you are experiencing when you're like, what is wrong? And I'm like, nothing. This is your fireball. It's fine. Oh my goodness, I finally see it. I am so sorry.
It's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but we understand, right? Neither of us are trying to hurt the other.
Well, and I know we've come so far since then. Like, specifically what I'm talking about is like 6 months ago, right? Like, we've come a long way since then. And also, I can finally see it in these words of, like, you're sending me an email of, I'm sensing these things. And I'm like, no, here's the evidence that I'm fine. But it's the not responding. Like, you weren't asking for content. You weren't asking for evidence that I'm okay. You are asking, without words, for a response to your distress. Mm-hmm. And in me not responding to the distress because I'm being It's like I was being left brain. In this example, mm-hmm. I was being left brain and you were being right brain. So you're, even though I was correct left brain, your right brain was correct in feeling abandoned because nothing was being tended to in the right brain. To oversimplify.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. How violating, because then I'm one of your perpetrators. I get it!
No.
I'm so sorry.
You're not a perpetrator. I don't like that.
Well, I don't like it either. I'm very sorry.
It's so gross how this shows up. Even in well-intended and, like, intentional relationships. I think that's one piece that helps me with, like, the not blaming. Like, it would be easy to just hate on all parents, right? Like, blame the mother. It's always the mother's fault. But, like, even really well-intentioned mothers can mess up and do mess up and have their own trauma. And, like, it's just, it's the never-ending cycle.
And the same for institutions as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're made up of hurting people.
Right.
So they also make mistakes, even when they're trying to help.
Right. And so that's where the brave spaces are so important, where it's not an us versus them. There's no sides to take. It's we're all looking at the what the problem is and finding solutions and common ground to address the problems, not identifying the people as the problem. Makes sense. But also not just excusing behavior and giving a free pass to people that don't want to look at their stuff and don't want, just want to continue reenacting everything at the expense of others. Like, it's not a permission to be a perpetrator.
Right. We have to own our stuff. We have to look at the pieces, even if it's at a pace. Even if it's paced at a rate that we can tolerate and learn and grow. And sometimes that's really slow when we have less support or there are harder things. But if we are supporting each other, then that increases capacity to tolerate just being accountable for our own growth. That's part of doing our own puzzle.
Yeah.
I love you so much.
I love you too.
I'm sorry that healing together has been hard and continues to be hard. Not because we're hard, not because loving you is hard, but because healing is hard.
Yeah.
And I think part of what is hard is the misattunement in that fundamentally, we are having to once again care for our caregivers by cleaning up the mess that they caused.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't malicious.
Right. It's like the cycle breakers, right? Where you have to stop the automatic responses and look at the pieces and then fix it. Instead of, like, a lot of times this has been generational, right? Like, family after family keeps going and somebody has to finally stop and say, I'm going to look at this and I'm going to do the really hard work of sitting with it, sitting with my pieces, sitting with your pieces. And trying to change it intentionally.
That's so powerful. That's what social justice is.
Yeah. And healing is hard because trauma is hard. And, like, we're not just healing a wound. We're, like, going back in because our bone has been broken and set inappropriate. Like, it just never got set. So we have to go back in and re-break the bones and then set them correctly and then heal them.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Okay, this has been epic. Anything else about disorganized attachment from Ana Gomez?
Yes.
Oh, just kidding. Okay, hit me with it.
So the next piece she talked about was using control as a way of attaching.
What?
Uh-huh. And the control can be punitive, which can be like aggressive and angry. So like children that act out like hurting people,
like keeping them away with aggression.
So wait, I want to make sure I'm understanding. We're talking about the child strategy.
Right.
Using control and aggression to avoid relationship,
right,
to avoid the danger of the relationship.
Right. So this is the disorganized strategy. So it's using both the avoidance and the approaching, right, at the same time. So it can be, it's
approaching energetically, but avoiding because it's negative.
Maybe.
I mean, quote, negative, right, in right, a binary parenting, you're not complying kind of way.
Right. So like an attempt to control the attachment, meaning getting to keep it, right, or have a say in it.
Like when they say negative attention is still attention.
Right.
I don't mean it's accurate, right, but that's the concept we're talking about.
Right. But it shows up both in punitive ways and in caretaking ways, which are opposite. Right. So there's this punitive, like angry, aggressive, prickly pear, like I'm going to hurt you if you get too close to me. If you try to connect to me, I'm going to punch you in the face. Or... and also at the same time, it can be caretaking of like controlling their caregiver through giving their caregiver what they need.
So almost reverse manipulation?
Right. Of like, I need you to stay. And the way I can get you to stay is to give you what you need. So I'm going to control you by giving you what you need.
Can I give a safe, neutral example of this?
Sure.
My kids have, for years, tried to trick me into, like, literally manipulating me into getting to stay up later by rubbing my feet. I don't need them to rub my feet. I don't ask them to rub my feet. And also when they do, I'm like, okay. Right. So that's that thing.
It could be, but I think...
but I feel like... oh, sorry.
Well, I don't know, because I wasn't there for all those times. But if it's just a voluntary fun thing, and it's not the only way they get to connect with you, that doesn't feel the same. It's when the only time you actually show up for them is if they are doing service for you. Then that would be them controlling you through caretaking. Like making you dependent on them because they're good caretakers, thus getting you to stay.
Oh yeah, that's different.
Yeah.
But that concept, I think, was a... I was trying to find a safe way to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it absolutely is a... they're trying to get you to let them stay up later by doing this thing so you won't notice. But in not in a relational trauma kind of way.
Right, right. So a healthy example of the pattern.
Yeah.
So in unhealthy examples, what does that even look like?
Well, she talked about having these kids who would like beg for attention and then kick you if you got too close. So it's like, it can be like both.
Like a hurt puppy.
Uh-huh. But like a... like, I think there's a book called I Hate You, Don't Leave Me.
This is when kids get misdiagnosed as borderline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and honestly, it's probably adults that are border... that have borderline traits, right? It's like that push and pull. It's like, I'm really, really scared of you, so I'm going to be very prickly and control, keep you at a distance that feels safe. And also, I'm terrified of being alone, of not having you. So I'm going to try to control you and like be super, almost like love bombing, get you to stay. I'm gonna take really good care of you to stay, but then I'm gonna push you away. And then I'm gonna pull you back in and push you away. Like, because both systems are going at the same time.
So back to the gas and brake.
Right.
Ew.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's that fun piece. You ready for the next piece?
Oh no, there's another one. Okay.
Yeah. There's also, so she talks about that being a role reversal. Like the child becoming a parent figure. And then also there's this good and bad split. Mm-hmm. So there's like good self and bad self. And it's very black and white. Yep.
Mean like Dante and Molly?
Uh-huh, that's exactly what I was just thinking. Right? She said that they're very binary states and that dissociated parts emerge and hold the very rigid states like Dante and Molly.
So what happens when you start seeing religious trauma clearly and it turns out that it's Molly who's bad and Dante who was right?
Well, I think
I'm gonna be sick.
No. I think that is still binary.
Mm-hmm.
Because Molly has pieces that were good and Dante has pieces that were good. But they also both have pieces that were wrong and harmful.
Also, in an even deeper level, I don't know if I can say this out loud or go there, but just acknowledging that I think I also experienced this with my parents, and that I have in littles, like originally, very young, I had one for the mother and one for the father, and both thought the other parent was going to rescue them.
Yeah.
So one, for each parent, there was one who was harmed by that parent and thought, so that's the bad parent, right? Mm-hmm. And thought the other one was the good parent.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Disorganized attachment that has to be dissociated into separate states.
Because there's no way for us to win the double binds.
No.
We cannot win.
Right. Well, so these are all strategies. Remember the quote at the beginning of last episode. They're all strategies that allow the child to coexist with the insufficiencies of their caregiver's presence. When you have caregivers that together create double binds, you have to have strategies for both, but those strategies are like oil and water. They cannot mix. So there have to be really strong barriers between those strategies. Does that make sense?
Yes. That's really uncomfortable.
I'm sorry. Do you want something funny?
Yes.
When you were saying one for the mother and one for the father, what I heard in my mind is one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now
yeah, four can't go.
Sorry.
Oh my goodness. Oh, this has been great fun.
Right? Do you want to hear the very last part?
Of all of it, or just disorganized
no,
attachment?
No, just the attachment.
Okay.
Strategies. She said that we have a misconception that calmness means regulated.
Yes.
But many calm-appearing people are in extremely high states of dysregulation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I am so calm right now.
Wait, what?
No, keep going.
No, let's come back to this.
I'm so calm. It's good.
Wait, are you pretending to emphasize the point, or you're really not okay with us doing this?
No, I think I'm going to be ready for a break in a minute.
That parts have communicated to you, which means you heard information and have received the message that we're done here. This is all we can offer. How many more pages of this is there?
of my notes?
Mm-hmm.
2.5.
Oh my goodness. 2.5 more pages?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a nice long break. It could be months, y'all. The shirts have spoken. We're going to hang up the laundry and honor the shirts.
There you go.
Well done, love. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing with us, really. And thanks for holding a brave space with us today.
You are welcome.
Let's go play. Thank you for listening. Your support of the podcast, the workbooks, and the community means so much to us as we try to create something together that's never been done before. Not like this. Connection brings healing. And you can join us on the community at www.systemspeak.com. We'll see you there.